Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After a two-week outbreak of distemper, that's an infectious respiratory disease, the Franklin County Dog Shelter is reopening today. But during the outbreak, shelter officials euthanized at least 84 dogs. Later on in the hour, we're going to talk about recognizing when a pet is sick and what to look for if you're adopting a pet from a shelter. Right now, we're talking about distemper, though. Joining us is Ohio State University veterinarian and shelter medicine expert, Dr. Jeanette O'Quinn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
I want to let listeners know that we did invite the Franklin County Dog Shelter to participate today. They're probably pretty busy, according to the communications office. No one was available. Dr. O'Quinn does not speak for the Franklin County Dog Shelter, but she did advise and give them input during the outbreak. So it's good to know. First, what is distemper? I've never known what it was before and was surprised that it's a respiratory illness. I thought it had something to do with like rabies or something.
Right. So distemper is actually a complicated disease. It's caused by a virus. And some of the most common signs are respiratory, but it also affects the skin and the neurologic system. So it can look very much like rabies.
Oh, okay. All right. Is there any way to detect it early?
So testing is really challenging. I think it would be helpful to share with your listeners that over half of the cases of distemper show either no clinical signs or very mild clinical signs. However, they're contagious throughout that period. The majority that do develop clinical signs develop coughing and nasal discharge and eye discharge. And that looks very much like several other very common and less serious respiratory illnesses that can impact dogs. And then a smaller percentage of them go on and develop seizures and neurologic signs associated with that disease.
By the time you're getting outward signs of distemper, the sneezing, the coughing, is it too late?
They're contagious, and they've been contagious for some time.
Okay.
At that point, but obviously, if you suspect you have distemper, see your veterinarian and have that animal tested for distemper.
But can they be cured?
There's no cure for distemper. So what we need to do is support them as they deal with the virus, just like we do with many other viruses.
And
so
isolate
treatments
them.
Can help them feel better.
Okay.
But it's still fatal in a significant number of the cases.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This hour, we're going to focus on sick dogs. In particular, we're talking about distemper today. It shut down the Franklin County Dog Shelter for a few weeks. They're reopening today. My guest is Dr. Jeanette O'Quinn. She's a clinical assistant professor in shelter medicine and a pioneer at Ohio State University's Veterinary Medical Center when it comes to shelter medicine. Actually, a national pioneer, I'm told. So if you have a question or comment about that, 614-292-8511 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is distemper contagious during the entirety of the illness?
Absolutely. Okay. So before they show clinical signs for several days, they may be contagious. Throughout the time that they have clinical signs, they're contagious. And then for several weeks, up to 4 months after they recover completely, they're still contagious.
Now, there are distemper shots. When you get a puppy or when you get something like that, people lots of times in the newspaper ads or whatever will say they've already gotten their distemper shots.
Right. This is a core vaccine, and that means that's one that's recommended for all dogs in the United States. And that's because distemper is prevalent in our communities, in stray dog populations, and we see that in owned animals that are not vaccinated. We also see it in raccoons, and there'll be large distemper outbreaks in areas that have a lot of raccoons. So distemper is out there. We need to be aware of it, and we need to keep vaccinating. It is an excellent vaccine, very effective.
Is it effective for life?
It is. It needs boosted. So
okay.
The recommendation is every 3 years once they reach adulthood. Now, I should add that for puppies, vaccination becomes complicated because they get some immunity from their mothers through the milk that they drink.
Uh-huh.
And that will prevent the vaccine from doing anything while they're puppies.
Okay.
And as they get older, as they reach 3, 4, 5 months of age, the antibodies from the mother decrease, and then the vaccine can actually be effective and stimulate the puppy's own immune system. And that's why we give a series of vaccines to puppies. So we don't consider them fully protected until they've completed their series at around 4 months of age.
And if you have a dog that has distemper, is it just pretty much recommended you isolate that dog forever?
Well, it will stop shedding within weeks to months after they recover from illness.
Okay.
So, but definitely during that period of time should be isolated. Absolutely.
How common is distemper in animal shelters if it's already part of the required vaccine when they come into the shelter, right?
Right. So puppies are always at high risk. As I mentioned, even
no
if they're
what.
Vaccinated early, gotcha. That may not have taken effect. So the majority of dog cases that we see are in puppies. However, a significant percentage of our adult dog population has never been vaccinated. So we've done studies in some shelters, and about 50 to 60% of the dogs entering shelters have protection against distemper when they enter, but the rest of them are susceptible.
Going back to this, I'm fascinated by this. If they're milk fed by their mothers, they may have antibodies from their mothers that would prevent the vaccine from working. Do the antibodies protect the puppy at all?
They do.
Okay.
They do. And so early on, and that's the whole purpose, right? So those antibodies are passed to the puppy to help protect it from things that may commonly encounter early in life while the immune system is still maturing. And then over time, those antibodies, of course, they have a lifespan, so they decrease. And at that time, the puppy's own immune system should pick up and start producing new antibodies. Of course, they have to be exposed to that virus or something like that virus. In our case, a vaccine is given to stimulate that immunity without causing any signs of disease. And so that's how we use vaccines to stimulate protection without an animal having to be exposed naturally to a disease.
You co-authored the book, The Guidelines for Standards of Care in Animal Shelters. What are the standard health or vaccination guidelines for shelters?
Right. So vaccinations are one very important way to prevent disease in shelters. The recommendations are to vaccinate for the core vaccines, and distemper, parvovirus are definitely core vaccines, on intake. So as soon as they come into the shelter, we know that it's going to take a couple days then for that dog to respond and develop immunity. So there's always this window where they could be exposed before that vaccine has had a chance to take effect. So vaccines alone are not going to take care of preventing disease in all cases, but certainly reduces the risk. And then we need to take other measures to help protect those animals.
And what are those? Isolating them first? Keeping them away from the general population before?
Right. Great question. So any animal that's showing signs of illness that could be contagious, so coughing, sneezing, nasal discharge, they should be isolated away from the rest of the dogs in the shelter. Absolutely. That's key to prevention.
How contagious is it? How much isolation do you need?
So distemper is highly contagious. Most cases
just in the air, then?
It can be airborne. Most cases are transmitted by close contact, so that's your highest risk.
Okay.
But it can be airborne, and coughing can spread that into the air.
Are shelters inspected to make sure that they're following these kinds of standards, or is there a honor system out there?
It's really a self-regulated industry. So there's not requirements in Ohio. There are not requirements in most states. And that's one of the reasons that the Association of Shelter Veterinarians and my colleagues felt it was really important to write these guidelines so that shelters knew what were considered essential to maintain the health and welfare of that population of animals, and so that they could have more details on how best to meet those needs.
How do you decide, or how does a shelter deduce or figure out that when they have an outbreak? What does an outbreak mean?
Right. So it's difficult to define. It's typically more than the expected number of cases at that time in that location. So for us, for distemper, one case is an outbreak. For other upper respiratory infections, it may be a lower number, maybe around 5 or 10%, where you would start to be concerned that there's an outbreak, that there's transmission occurring beyond what should be expected. It's so essential for shelters to protect the animals in the shelter and prevent disease from occurring because they're in the shelter. And that's a real challenge whenever you have a lot of animals living under the same roof, right? Because they're coming in from all different locations. They're bringing different things with them. And each additional one increases the risk, right? So we have to rely on vaccination, sanitation, isolation, those types of things to protect the animals. I think parents with school-age children will understand this best when they think about sending their kids to school, right? Somebody comes in sick, pretty soon a lot of the kids are sick and more of the kids are sick. And then we keep the kids home. That's kind of like isolation, right? So that we're not continuing to spread that. So we take those same principles and apply them in the population setting at the shelter.
How do shelters, what kind of protocol is there for outbreak response?
So each individual shelter really needs to develop that for their own shelter. So many factors play into that, that there's not a one size fits all, like I can pull it off the shelf and use it in any shelter. So they need to develop one specific for their shelter. It's going to involve first.
But they should have a protocol.
They absolutely should have a protocol. I'd say the majority don't. They're so overwhelmed and understaffed in most cases, it's difficult. And so this occurs at varying levels, but it's ideal to have a plan in place, make some decisions in advance so that it can be implemented instead of having to make decisions in the moment of a crisis. But surveillance is critical. So they need to be monitoring and aware of what diseases are active in that community and in their shelter, and looking for changes in severity of disease where they might want to do some more diagnostics and see if they have something else, something new that came in, increases in the number of cases, things like that, that are going to trigger them to do some more investigation and maybe take additional measures to prevent disease spread.
At what point in a typical protocol would the euthanization come in?
So euthanization is going to be it's a challenging thing to discuss, and it's an even harder decision to have to make. Ultimately, you need to protect the rest of your population. You also need to look at the prognosis for that individual animal, especially with distemper. Prognosis is not very good. Especially if they have pneumonia and they're going to potentially progress to neurologic signs, that animal is suffering right now. And so there's a welfare concern that needs to be considered. We also need to look at other issues. So is this animal adoptable? So there are animals in the shelter that are really not adoptable for various reasons, maybe other health conditions that they have that are progressive, chronic issues, or for behavior reasons. We need to protect the public from dog bites. So certain aggressive animals, they're brought into the shelter to protect the community from aggressive animals. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense to put them back into the community. So it's a very complicated grouping of things. It's not just one factor that goes into that decision.
Let's take Lisa in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I was wondering, instead of vaccinations, booster vaccinations, what about the use of titers?
Right. So titers.
What are titers?
So titers, I mentioned the antibodies that are passed from the mother's milk into the puppy, and mm-hmm. the fact that when we vaccinate, we're triggering the immune system. What the immune system then does is develop these antibodies. And a titer is a way to measure how many antibodies are present. For some diseases, distemper being one of them, if we know that a titer level over a certain amount is pretty strongly associated with protection. So if the animal is exposed, they're probably not going to get it. There's no guarantee there. Titers are a great tool. They really tell us more about the past. So we know when we have positive titers that the animal was vaccinated or previously infected and now has an antibody level that's considered protective moving forward. What we don't know is how far forward that's going to stay positive. So it's a very useful tool. And can be, in the short term, used to make decisions about vaccination. But we do know that dogs that have been vaccinated against distemper over time, and it varies for each dog, will lose those antibody levels just like they do when they're puppies and maybe become susceptible. So it varies from dog to dog how their response is.
Dog to dog being size or breed or what?
It's really not associated with size or breed at all. Maybe associated with the number of vaccines. So a dog that's been vaccinated 3 or 4 times in its life may be protected for a much longer period than a dog that's been vaccinated only once in its life.
Okay, Lisa, thanks for that call.
Thanks.
We're going to continue our conversation about how to figure out when your pet's sick. We've been talking with Dr. Jeanette O'Quinn. She's clinical assistant professor in shelter medicine at Ohio State University Veterinary Medical Center. We'll keep her on, I hope, for a little while longer to talk about how to find a pet in a shelter and how you know, some of the questions and things to look for if you're in the market. We'll get some emails. If you want to send us an email, allsides@wosu.org. And if you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Dogs have an amazing sense of smell with more than 200 million scent receptors. They can smell things that seem, you know, it's unreal. Some studies have shown dogs can sniff out cancer and low blood sugar in humans. For people, however, detecting when our pets are sick isn't quite that simple. Joining us by phone is animal behavior expert and director of behavior service at the University of Pennsylvania's Veterinary Hospital, Dr. Carlo Siracusa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Also with us is assistant professor at Ohio State University's Veterinary Medical Center, Dr. Lori Millward.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
And Dr. Jeanette O'Quinn is still with us. She's clinical assistant professor in shelter medicine at OSU's Veterinary Medical Center. Thanks again for staying on with us.
Great. Happy to be here.
We've been talking about the whole shelter thing, and I can't remember. Did we talk about whether distemper is the most prevalent or what other things should people be looking for in a shelter?
It's certainly not the most common disease. It's one that shelters are constantly on the lookout for and dread because of its severity and its difficulty to manage. There are other viruses and bacteria out there that cause a respiratory infection. I guess you could call it a common cold.
Mm-hmm.
And those are much more common. So don't be afraid of that in a shelter. Just be aware of that. Those are highly treatable, and your veterinarian can help you with managing those cases. So not every cough is distemper.
Dr. Siracusa, what dog behaviors can you look for when it comes to illness? I know that it's common that, you know, if they're turning away from their food or water, though that's a red flag, but that's a red flag. What about ones that aren't red flags?
So I think that it depends on the pathology that you are looking for. For acute infections like distemper, or you mentioned earlier, rabies, there are usually clinical signs that appears pretty fast in the development of the disease. So you will see some clear clinical signs aside from the generic behavior changes and specific behavior changes that you have mentioned. Some infections, they do cause very specific behavior signs. For example, in distemper, like there might be in a small percentage of cases changes like compulsive behaviors, or in rabies, it's famous, the case for aggression.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that behavioral signs as only or prevalent signs are more relevant in chronic diseases, the clinical signs are subtle, and so the changes in behavior are usually the only sign that the animal is sending us on a regular, like consistent basis. I think, however, that the situation is quite different from clinical, like non-behavioral clinical signs. Why? Because I think that being able to detect, the ability of detecting behavior signs is influenced also by the knowledge that the person has of dog behavior or cat behavior. Unfortunately, there is a pop culture of dog behavior, about dog behavior, which is often also perpetrated by the media, bias people's attention to some behaviors that are usually interpreted as, for example, signs of dominance or the animal being lazy or the animal being vicious, just to give you an example. So, for example, if a dog is reluctant to move at some point, if you talk to people, the first explanation would be that the animal is being lazy or that the animal is trying to escalate its hierarchy within the group or the family. But in many cases, there is a clinical reason, for example. Maybe the animal is in pain and is reluctant to move and might even try to bite just because passive movements when you try to push or pull the animal might cause pain. So it's a little bit more difficult. And also signs tend to be unspecific.
So, Dr. Millward, then sometimes people are bringing a pet to a behaviorist or, you know, to a trainer when they really need to be bringing it to a veterinary, a specialist, you know, or a veterinarian who can look at what he's talking about.
Absolutely. And I think that any variation from the norm is a concern. And I always tell my clients, sometimes they tell me, I'm not sure if this is really anything, but I've noticed this. And I always listen very carefully to what my clients have to say to me because they know their animals better than anybody else. And it's those changes from their normal behavior that are actually messages to us that maybe they are experiencing a physical illness rather than just behavior.
Which makes me, you know, you think about the challenge then of shelters when they're bringing in an unknown.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. That's a great point. So one of the challenges of managing animals in shelters is that we don't know what their behavior was like outside of the shelter unless owners have shared that with us. But even that's limited information. Also, other health and exposures, they may have illnesses that are not obvious when they first come in. And we need to evaluate them all with limited background information. So we don't have the benefit of the history and talking with the owner in many cases.
Yeah.
So we become very good observers.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Dr. Jeanette O'Quinn. She's an expert in shelter medicine at OSU's Veterinary Medical Center. Also with us, Dr. Lori Millward. She's also with the Ohio State University Veterinary Medical Center. And Dr. Carlo Siracusa, he's an animal behavior expert and director of the Behavior Service at the Veterinary Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about, you know, when your dog's sick, how do you know, or what can you tell a vet about what you're seeing that has brought you there? Sometimes it's often not obvious. Questions, comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have some emailers and callers that want to get back to the vaccination thing. Email from Alex says, generally speaking, is there a point at which we should worry about our pets being over-vaccinated? It seems like every time I go to the vet, they recommend something new, and I want to trust the science, but breeders I have spoken to think the over-vaccination is a huge problem. Dr. Millward, what about that?
Oh, that's a great point, and I think that a good veterinarian is going to tailor a vaccine protocol for your pet based upon their lifestyle. And once again, that goes into getting a good history from the client and finding out if the animal goes into the woods or goes camping or hiking. Maybe we want to talk about, do we need a leptospirosis vaccine for that pet, or do we need to vaccinate for Lyme disease? Hmm. And it also varies from location in the United States. There are some prevalences of certain illnesses that occur more often in certain states than others. One of those being Lyme disease. I definitely think that when you're discussing vaccines with your veterinarian, you should always discuss what the core vaccines are for whether you're bringing in a cat or a dog. And sticking to those core vaccines is very important. The distemper vaccine is one of our core vaccines. And as we've recently seen, it's very important to keep up with regular vaccination protocols for that particular virus. In addition, it's local regulations that require certain animals to be vaccinated for rabies as well. Mm-hmm. So just having a very honest conversation with your veterinarian is very important in tailoring those vaccines to each individual pet's needs and lifestyle is the most important point so that you don't over-vaccinate.
Elizabeth in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Actually, it was a strange question. I just got back from Ireland. I was training service dogs for disabilities, and I had to bring my dog over because I wasn't leaving her. And I had to get her revaccinated as soon as I got there because one of them went up, and I said, oh, gosh, this is going to cost a lot. Because it cost me $132 average a year every time I need vaccinations. And mm-hmm. they were like, hey, here's a vaccination. And I'm like, okay, how much? And they said, 12 euros. And I went, what? And they said, no, it's 12 euros. It's part of a health scheme because they don't want any dogs getting sick. And I said, well, why doesn't the United States do that? We have so many dogs with so many dog lovers. Why does it cost $100 to $250 every time we need vaccinations?
Yeah, why does it cost that much?
Well, I think...
I mean, obviously, Ireland is socialized medicine, and I think they probably apply the same sort of system to pets then, I guess. But why is it so expensive?
Well, a lot of it goes into the actual cost that the company, the manufacturer of those vaccines, places upon the vaccine that the veterinary clinic has to pay to even get it into the location itself. And, you know, we're not nonprofits, most of us. And so we do need to add on some degree of a charge so that we're not losing money or at least breaking even because it is a business.
Dr. Siracusa, as far as behavior goes with pets, I've talked to people who say they just don't want to put their dogs through that, like people who say they don't want to put their kids through vaccination shots. They hurt, they're painful and that kind of a thing. What do we know about what dogs feel when they get a needle stuck in them?
Yeah, well, they definitely don't feel good.
Okay.
They don't like it. We tend to say things like, oh, my dog loves the vet. I think this is a really exceptional case.
Yeah.
Like most dogs are afraid of the vet. The vet is a terrible person and inflicts pain. That said, as I was saying before, we especially veterinarians as a professional category, we have to be trained to recognize what are the behaviors that are signs that the dog is becoming nervous. Many of these behaviors, unfortunately, are misunderstood. For example, a dog that would jump, start to jump excitedly, not necessarily aggressively, on the vet, it might mean that the dog is becoming nervous, and so it's losing the ability to communicate appropriately. So, first of all, recognize the signs. And it's good that now there are initiatives, actually, that also tend to educate the dog owner, so the owner can understand if that is a normal behavior or not for the patient, for their dog. And then there are things that we can definitely do. Puppies are easy to handle. They are small. Even a huge Rottweiler, when he's a puppy, is a puppy. He's small and he can be easily restrained. So many times we rely on this, that they are easy to restrain, but then when they become adult, they become big and upset with us. And then it's a problem and it's even more stressful. So there are things that we can start to do when they are puppies to improve the perception. So from having an appropriate body language and non-threatening body language when we interact with the puppy, to make sure that the entire handling, restraining, and injected the vaccine is associated with something positive. So one of the tools that we always have at our behavior clinic is baby food. And while we do a procedure that might be perceived as negative by the puppy, we try to keep him focused on something else. There is a treat, a positive interaction. This is very important because puppies will bring, will form memories. Every time that we have a negative interaction with them, we'll form memories. And even when it looks that they are okay, usually what they are doing, they are freezing. They are just trying to survive. Oh my gosh, maybe today I will survive to this bad guy. And so they don't show any behavior. But they are still stressed and they are still storing negative information. And it's well clear now what is the role of stress, especially chronic stress, even on the immune response. So it's also medically appropriate to keep a dog happy through our medical procedures to have a better response and a better recovery if the dog should be sick.
Dr. O'Quinn, you wanted to talk about the cost of vaccinations too?
Yeah, I would like just to follow up on that. I thought it was a great question, and I want to. I don't want people to avoid vaccinations because of the cost. There are other options out there for low-cost vaccines, and I wanted to make sure that the viewers were aware of that. So there are vaccine clinics that are put on by various entities in almost every community that can provide a lower-cost alternative. And the way they do that is to get reduced cost on those vaccines, and that's all they're providing. Part of that larger $100, $200 cost associated with vaccines when you visit the veterinarian is because they're getting a complete physical exam and an office visit. They're evaluating all the systems, you know, heart, lungs, all of these other things, looking for other illnesses. Very important to get that checkup on a regular basis. So that's part of that cost. All of it isn't vaccines. But for those who can't do that, there are low-cost alternatives. I know the Franklin County Dog Shelter offering $5 vaccines coming up here really soon. But again, in every community, you'll find a low-cost alternative to receive those core vaccines that are so vital to protecting our pets' health.
Elizabeth, thanks for that call. We will continue our conversation. You just heard from Dr. Jeanette O'Quinn from the OSU Veterinary Medical Center. Also with us, Dr. Lori Millard from OSU's Veterinary Medical Center. And by phone, Dr. Carlos Siracusa, animal behavior expert at the University of Pennsylvania. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When a beloved pet seems a bit off, it might be more than just a bad day. Could be a sign of a mild or perhaps more serious illness. We're talking about caring for your pets and how to know when they're sick. Still with us by phone is animal behavior expert at the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Carlos Siracusa. Also, OSU Assistant Professor of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Lori Millward, and Dr. Jeanette O'Quinn. She is an expert in shelter medicine at the OSU Veterinary Medical Center. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Siracusa, going back to the issue of nervousness and that kind of a thing, you sometimes write for the New York Times, and in one of your opinion pieces, you wrote that drugs are just one of the tools available to treat behavioral problems, but rarely do they represent the only or the main option. What are other options for treating behavior? And let's talk about being nervous going to the vet. That's a personal thing for me. My dog was always just a basket of nerves.
There are many things that can be done at different levels. medication like drugs, it's one option, but for this specific case, going to the vet is usually the last option that we consider. We start, first of all, considering environmental changes, so things that we can do both in the dog house and at the clinic to make the experience overall better. So, for example, not associating a specific routine with going to the vet.
Mm-hmm.
So just a few days ago, we had a patient that didn't like to go on a car ride because the only time when he was getting the opportunity to jump into the car was to go to the vet.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, even breaking this association is a good thing. Just starting to practice the same routine that you usually practice to go to the vet, just to have some fun. So jump on the car and go to the dog park and have fun, they come back home. So keep it easy and happy. Then also giving to the owner good tools to manage the anxiety, nervousness, aggressiveness. For example, instead of recurring last minute to a muzzle, we can, as a puppy, tell to the owner, why don't you train your dog to wear a muzzle? And so it's not a negative experience for him. Like we can do training associating, progressive training associating a positive stimulus, as I was saying. So what about if we have a basket muzzle, which allows the dog to breathe and pant and drink and take treats, and we just put some peanut butter at the beginning in this basket muzzle. We put it on the floor at home, and the dog would just stick his nose to get the peanut butter. So I start to create a positive association. And we start in this way to create this positive association. And then if one day we need to do a particularly aversive procedure and we need to muzzle the dog, the owner can come with it, with his own basket muzzle, and it's not going to be bad. We can do changes also in the way in which we conduct the visit. So if we know that the dog is a little bit shy, instead of starting with the... we usually tend to start our physical exam from the heads of the dog, but making eye contact and facing the dog is usually threatening to the dog. So maybe we might just modify a little bit our protocol if we see that the dog is very nervous and start with the less threatening things like ausculting the heart and the lungs of the dog and then going to the head at the end.
Mm.
Using food is another big one, as we were saying before, to create a positive association. Then we can also use natural products for which we have some scientific evidence that they work. For example, pheromones, mm-hmm. dog pheromones, which are natural chemicals that are produced by dogs to communicate to other dogs, I'm okay with you, I'm calm, just you should also take it easy. And there is a specific pheromone that is called appeasing pheromone that comes in diffusers. And for example, we can plug one of these in our consult room. Make sure that the table is not cold, that it's clean, that it's not slippery. So there are several small things that we can plan with the owner. Another thing, if I know that a patient of mine is nervous, I usually make agreements with the owner to say, oh, well, don't come in. Don't spend too much time in the waiting room because there are other dogs and a lot of stimuli. Let me know when you are here. I will bring you in from the side entrance and we will walk directly into the room. So minimize the waiting time. There are all these little things that all together can build a better experience and a better memory for our dogs.
I was surprised when Dr. Siracusa was talking about the memory that dogs have. And Dr. Millward, you're like, oh, absolutely. I mean, something that happens to a dog as young as a puppy can stay with them for their whole lives.
Absolutely. I just had an interesting experience about 2 weeks ago where I had a student bring in their dog to see us for the first time in Ohio State. And I noticed that this puppy, this young puppy that normally should be happy, wiggly, excited to see new people, was fearful and was kind of shying away from my touch or even coming up to greet me. And I thought that was strange. And I said to her, I said, how did previous veterinary visits go? And she said, it was awful, Dr. Millward. They held him down and had to force him to have these shots. And I think he had a really bad experience. And then she said, I find it strange that he was afraid here, though, because he's never been here
before.
Yeah,
how does he know you're a vet?
They know.
And is there something, a smell or something in the vet office?
I think so. Well, Dr. Siracusa was talking about pheromones, and, yeah, and dogs release pheromones when they're fearful. So maybe there were some of those in the environment.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, the white coat. They remember the white coats that you wear. It's just your mannerisms. They know something's up. They're very smart. And it doesn't even matter if it's the same location. It was just a completely different veterinary environment. And this dog remembered. It was impressive.
Is it Claren or Cloran?
Hello, yes. Yeah. Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm fine. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this show. I think education and just discussing this as the first, you know, combatants to just awful things that had to happen in the past week. So I really appreciate the conversation. I actually had a question, especially for your guest from OSU. I had to take my dog to your emergency services before. Unfortunately, he ate grapes. And I was wondering if there was any kind of resource you can provide to kind of know if you need to go to the emergency services. Let's say it's a weekend and your vet's not in, or if there's a phone number to call. And also just the second part, if there's any pet insurance that you would recommend, because those tend to be a little bit higher in cost. And okay, I will take answer off the air.
All right. Thanks a lot. We'll talk about pet insurance, but how do you know when it's time to go to an emergency room with your dog?
That's a great question. And I think that there are some resources out there that you can use at home. You mentioned that your dog had eaten some grapes, which are toxic to dogs. The ASPCA actually has a great website where you can call a 1-800 number. And for a small fee, you can consult with one of their professionals about if a certain item that your pet might have ingested is toxic or not. If you're ever concerned or have a question, just pick up the phone and call your regular veterinarian. That is absolutely perfectly fine to do. And it's better to ask something that doesn't need immediate treatment rather than wait too long and then run into some problems down the road. We're always happy to answer those questions at Ohio State. You can always call us. And even after hours, we have veterinary students that answer the phones that are in our emergency department, can talk to you about what might have occurred and what our next steps need to be.
The ASPCA, is that the American Society
Prevention of Animal Cruelty?
Yeah. Okay. So, we'll have a link to that website on ours at WOSU.org/allsides. Just some signs that your dog might be ill, though. We looked them up and we found top 10 signs that your dog may be ill. And I wondered, you know, if you guys could give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. What about bad breath or drooling? That's a sign.
Absolutely. That is, those two together.
I mean, we talk about dog breath. Isn't that inherently bad?
Like the old Snoopy.
But my dog never
cartoons.
Had. Yeah, right.
That actually is a strong indicator that there's dental disease going on. And dogs get dental disease just like we do. They get plaque, they get gingivitis, they break their teeth, they even get infections. And that is usually associated with bad breath. The drooling is interesting. If you notice your dog maybe drooling more in a car or that sort of thing, that could actually be a sign of nausea or nervousness. That's another sign of anxiety, is excessive salivation. So if you notice a consistent foul odor to the mouth, and perhaps that the animal is drooling more, maybe less reluctant or more reluctant to eat dry food and wants softer treats and canned food, those are strong signs that there may be dental disease going on.
Dr. Siracusa, I wanted to ask you something, and I forgot to do so earlier. Why is it that dogs don't show pain? They, you know, one of the things we're looking at is behavior changes, you know, and a lot of times with a dog, they continue frolicking even when they're on their death's door. Why is that?
So, I want to say that dogs don't show pain, but they show different signs of pain that we might not be able to see. First of all, the same that happened to us humans. Sometimes we can be in pain. We experience pain at different times throughout the day with a different intensity. And sometimes it depends on the motivation that we have to do something. If we are very excited, very nervous, we might overcome our pain and do this. So we might have a little bit of pain, for example, in our knee or foot, but we might still be able to go to work and do whatever we have to do, and then we come back home and want to rest a little bit. So for dogs especially, when they are highly motivated to do something, so for example, we bring them outside and we entice them to play with a ball, they might still be able to play, or they might walk. Or if they see a dog and they become very excited and they go bananas, mm-hmm. they might still pull and lunge and bark. But at that point, they have so much adrenaline into circulation, will cause sympathetic arousal, that they are overcoming their pain. Actually, what I will look at are the behaviors that the dog does when the environment is relatively calm, and even subtle behavior, like how slow is the dog to change position, to sit down, to stand up, and sometimes they do things because we expect them to do things. So we ask our dog to sit, we see that it is a little bit slow, and we keep insisting, sit, sit, sit. At some point the dog will do it, but the reluctance and the time, it might tell you something. Some other times what happens is that the same pain is causing a different type of what we call stress response. This, the dog might be freezing because of the pain, so it's not showing anything. It's actually quiet and calm, apparently calm in a spot. Or some other times the dog is showing what we call displacement behaviors. For example, this is something that happened to us when we have abdominal pain, and horses show the same thing. We can become nervous and actually walk around. And this per se is a manifestation of pain. Huh. So the increased level of activity. So it's variable, and it influenced by the disease. But it is also influenced by the temperament of the dog. Each one has a different way of coping with pain. So dogs experience pain as much as we do. The difference is that they have a much worse ability to control their environment. We can decide if we are in pain to, okay, I will not do this. Dogs, they depend on us. If we are not able at catching their pain, they will still do what we ask them to do, up to a certain degree. At some point, they will be very reluctant or they will show aggression. Mm-hmm. But they try to cope with it.
Dr. Carlos Siracusa, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Dr. Carlos Siracusa is an animal behavior expert at the Veterinary Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Also, Dr. Jeanette O'Quinn, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Dr. O'Quinn is a clinical assistant professor in shelter medicine at OSU's Veterinary Medical Center. And Dr. Lori Millward, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Lori Millward is an assistant professor at the OSU Veterinary Medical Center. Thanks for your emails. Thanks for your calls. And thanks especially for listening. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat, All Sides interns Walter Haupt, Jessica Shakespeare, and Shelby Powers, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.